Welcome to the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brandon Shea Metella, from merry old Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. And I'm very much looking forward to this episode. I'm very excited because we're going to be talking about our first Alfred Hitchcock film, The Pleasure Garden. Yes, right on. And joining me, as always, is our wonderful co-hosts, Tom Caldwell from Regina. How's it going, Tom?
Hey, happy to represent Saskatchewan.
Word.
Keeping the Canadian content going here.
Represent East Coast. Well, we're more in the center of the country, but...
Prairies.
Prairie Coast. Yes. And also joining me is Chris Haig from merry old England. How are you doing, Chris?
I am doing very well. I'm doing even better now that you've done the East Coast represent shout out. That was my favorite thing I've heard all day. So thank you for that. It was awesome.
It couldn't be farther.
Yes. What coast are you on in England?
We're not on a coast. We're like a landlocked, like, city. I think technically we're northwest? Northwest?
North Coast. Word.
Fair enough.
No gang signs on camera.
No gang signs.
So... Do you mind if I pull my surprise on you two guys?
Yeah, Tom told us he's got something he's pulling out of a magic hat for us here.
Hitchcock podcast trivia.
Oh.
Three questions, pop trivia.
Each or...
And now, I want you guys to kind of do, like, if you know the answer, go, hey,
okay,
or
yeah.
Hello.
I'll insert the Jeopardy
game show format. So, Mr. Hitchcock was raised in Leytonstone/Essex. Name the world-famous jock also born there.
Jock? Is that like a horse rider?
Like an athlete.
An athlete. Ooh. Is it the guy on the bike with the cancer thing and then...
You have to ring your bell.
Ding, 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 ding. Okay, my guess is the guy on the bicycle... I could be wrong. I don't know anything about sports. Who's the guy?
I really don't. I'm laughing at the guy you're trying to describe, like Lance Armstrong. Like, oh yeah, the cancer bike, cheap guy. Yeah.
Anybody?
Okay, so it's Livingstone.
5-4.
I don't know.
David Beckham.
What?
Ooh, oh, okay, the soccer
there you
guy.
Go. Some pretty big names from one small town. Question number two. Remember, you have to ring in. What year was Psycho released?
Ding, 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 ding.
Mr. Brandon Shea?
1960.
Right on. Point for Brandon. Are you proud of yourself?
Yes.
Now, final question in the round. What happened to Mr. Hitchcock in 1979 after a very long wait? What became of him? What did he receive?
Well, he didn't die because he died in 1980.
Ding, ding. Did he receive like an honorary Oscar?
Oh, kind of. Almost as important. A Knight of the Order of the British
Empire. Oh, an OBE. Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
So this was in, they call it the New Year's Honors, 1979. And he died in April of 1980.
Oh, God.
So asked by a reporter why it took the Queen so long to knight Hitchcock, he quipped, I suppose it was a matter of carelessness. So you took it well.
Yeah.
But no, that's quite the honor.
Chris is like
a very appropriate.
Oh,
honor.
An OBE? Yeah. Oh, that's nothing. I have one of those.
No. Like if it was a proper knight, that's big. But we have the New Year's honors list every year, so it's always first few days of January, and then it's the
formal title.
Well, that's it. You either get it's like a
knight commander of the most excellent order of the British.
Yeah, you get like a CBE, OBE, MBE, and then like a sir or a dame or whatever. So there is like a cool hierarchy of it.
Well, before we jump into our actual discussion as well, this is where we bring in the listener interaction. So I posted a question on Twitter the other day. And I actually posted a couple, and I wanted to mention them because I thought they were a lot of fun. So I had asked a bunch of people, I said, what was your first Hitchcock movie? And I'll just use Twitter handles on this here. Kessel Junkie said, Psycho, but I was too young to appreciate it. It was on TV. First one I saw and appreciated was Vertigo. Then I saw Rear Window and was hooked. Suzanne Williamson said, Rear Window, my dad introduced me to all the best stuff, Star Trek, Hitchcock, and horror films. Neil S. Bulk said, Rear Window, 1983 reissue, went twice that weekend. So we got a little bit of a theme going on here. Film Buff Baker said, Psycho, when I was about 10, hid behind the cushions for most of it. Andrew says, Rear Window. It made a deep impression on 10-year-old me and caused me to watch and absorb every Hitchcock film I could find. Carl Wonders said North by Northwest. Smorgasbord said The Birds for me. And YY Chromo said Rope. Film studies at uni in the 90s. The next day we watched Psycho. Awesome week.
Nice.
Wow. That's a great bunch of fan feedback.
Yeah, and then Oh Brother Podcast said The Birds, late night BBC with Mum, and they spelled Mum, M-U-M. Uh-oh. So
very British. Yeah. They had marmalade.
And then I also asked another question. I said, which Hitchcock movie would you like to see remade, and who would you like to direct it or star in it? Manish Mather said, Nicole Kidman would make a great Marnie as directed by Jane Campion. Ooh. I thought that was interesting.
Sorry, Nicole Kidman would make a great anything.
Yeah. And Mike Schindler, I'm thinking he's half joking on here. He says, I want Gus Van Sant to do his planned second remake of Psycho starring Viggo that he said he would have deviated drastically from the original. So I'm guessing that must be Viggo Mortensen. And I'm guessing that's a joke because Gus Van Sant, for those that don't know, did a scene by scene remake of Psycho. So I thought that was kind of funny. Funny comment. And let's see, I think we got some comments as well on this thread here on our Facebook page. So let me take a quick look here. Yes, we had Zach Moore, my friend, said Psycho, directed by Gus Van Sant, starring Vince Vaughn. And I'm like, I think that was already done. Brian Weir said, I'd love to see Spielberg direct a modern-day version of Foreign Correspondent. It has the premise of some great set-piece ideas like the original. And I said, oh, that's a nice idea. And he said he would love to see him redo the famous scene with Edmund Gwenn as the lovable old gent escorting him to his hotel when he's really an assassin preparing to kill him at the first opportunity. If Spielberg could get a lovable older actor to play him, it would be fantastic. Any ideas who? And then Brian submitted Richard Attenborough. And then I responded with Albert Finney, maybe?
Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford.
This is really... I think Richard Attenborough is dead, though, isn't he now?
Oh, no, he's not.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you watch Rogue One, you know, being dead doesn't stop you from being in a movie anymore, right? So.
True, true. What would you guys do? You know, like, if you were to remake Hitchcock? If you could completely... I want this and this and this director.
Oh, I was thinking Quentin Tarantino, but I wasn't thinking of a specific title.
Oh, Tarantino doing Psycho, that'd be good.
Oh, yeah.
I would think Fincher. Ooh, Fincher's got to get his hands on a
remake. Can you imagine Psycho out of chronological sequence?
like Pulp Fiction?
Yeah. And there'd be cereal boxes everywhere.
Yeah.
Nice.
See, I'd want someone to do a remake of, you know, The Man Who Knew Too Much? Like the 34 version? I'd love to see, like, Sam Mendes do it, but then maybe do, like, maybe have a same-sex couple do it. You know, like an interest.
You know, see, some of these I haven't seen for so long. Foreign Correspondent, I remember really, really, really enjoying it, but I can't remember what this guy's talking about. I'm like, I don't even remember this scene, so I don't remember. It's been so long since I've watched it.
What about Psycho with modern spy technology, video cameras, microphones, etc.?
I think that's what a lot of people want. What about North by Northwest? I think most people would say Psycho, right? But, you know, get something, you know, one of those other ones. But,
well, they have remade a lot, or at least inspired, so like modern Rear Window, there's that...
Disturbia, yeah. So that, Egon Braga here said Rear Window and The Birds, and I said Rear Window's been remade into the film Disturbia. I haven't seen it yet myself, so...
I know, I have, but weirdly, it doesn't reference the fact it's a Rear Window remake. Mm-hmm. They just go, "Oh yeah, no, we just like the film, so we unofficially remade
it." Right,
right. But it's all right. Mm-hmm. It's all right.
Well, I got a couple more comments to finish up this thread. Den Ralph said, "The Birds with Dakota Johnson." Now, I was thinking Dakota Fanning when he said that. Who's Dakota Johnson?
The main woman in 50 Shades of Grey. And I think she's Melanie Griffith's daughter.
Okay.
Am I thinking of the right person?
And then he chose Patty Jenkins as a director. She did a great job with Wonder Woman. And I haven't seen Wonder Woman yet, but I saw Monster. Yeah. And Monster was absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, and then one more comment we got on our Twitter page for that. So Karen Peters said, they should not remake Hitchcock movies. And I said, but even Hitchcock wasn't afraid to remake Hitchcock. He did The Man Who Knew Too Much. And Karen responded, but he could. The only acceptable way is to twist the genre, like throw Mama from the Train. So, and which is a remake kind of Strangers on the Train.
I'd like to thank Egon for commenting on Facebook. He's my friend here in Regina, that the graphic design of the Mr. Hitchcock wearing headphones.
Oh, nice.
Piece of artwork for us.
Thanks, Egon.
Good input there.
Yeah.
Right on. Any more comments from you guys on this topic before we move into the movie?
I get why people are quite sensitive about Hitchcock and why, you know, oh, they shouldn't remake it, all that sort of thing. But like you said, deviations from it can be quite interesting. I personally would like to see a film that does, like, the first half of Hitchcock, but then it completely flips it, and it's like Marion accidentally kills Norman. It turns out he was innocent, and then it's a completely different film.
Like a parallel universe.
You know, like taking those little conceits and just making them completely different. Mm-hmm. So I'm up for that. But then equally, if someone wants to remake North by Nerdwear,
subtle
plug for his own podcast.
I've been editing it for like 2 days because I was ill earlier this week.
So I enjoyed the episodes I listened to, but I sure wouldn't be listening to them with my grandmother.
Nor would I.
Yeah, settle there, Chris. I'm going to do that now, too. Yeah, you know, I would like to see about people remaking Hitchcock films on Melodic Treks and Warp 5 on Trek FM. I mean, whoops. Oh, that was a little slip.
I have nothing to plug.
In all seriousness, though, wasn't the rumours a little while back of Michael Bay apparently buying the rights to The Birds? And he was apparently going to do a remake of it. And people were up in arms saying, oh, this is awful, Michael Bay! And how great would it be, The Rock?
With Vin Diesel.
Well, if Michael Bay did that, those birds would have, like, torpedoes attached to them or something.
Be drones.
Yeah. The drones, yeah.
Well, and whether or not people are remaking the films, his influence is everywhere, and it just reaches into every, you know, so many tangential film themes and references and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't really have to remake the whole films all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's a good subject matter.
Right on. Thank you, everybody, for participating in the Twitter and Facebook pages. We appreciate that. We're going to try and have I'm going to try and put a question up a couple of days ahead of time from the Twitter page and the Facebook page and get some interaction prior to us recording, so we got something to have some listener interaction with. But why don't we move along to the Pleasure Garden? The Pleasure Garden, Hitchcock's first film, was released on November 3rd, 1925 in Germany and January 14th, 1927 in the UK. Now, Wikipedia lists the running time for this film as 75 minutes. However, the version that we watched on YouTube was only 1 hour and 11 seconds. Now, this is considered Hitchcock's first film and was based on the novel of the same name by Oliver Sandys. Was that Sandys? 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 Oliver Sandys is the pseudonym of Margaret Florence Laura Jarvis. Now, the screenplay was written by Elliot Stannard. This was not the first or the last time that he would work with Hitchcock. Previously, they worked together on Patty, The Next Best Thing, and would work again on The Mountain Eagle, The Lodger, Downhill, The Farmer's Wife, Easy Virtue, Champagne, and The Manxman. The cinematographer for this movie was Gaetano Di Ventimiglia. I hope I'm saying that right. My Italian's not very good. But he was also known as the as Baron Gaetano di Ventimiglia of the House of Ventimiglia. The Ventimiglia are a noble Italian family that once held fiefdoms in Liguria, France, Spain, and southern Italy. He would work with Hitch two more times on The Mountain Eagle and The Lodger. This film was produced by Gainsborough Pictures, and Gainsborough Pictures was a British film studio based on the south bank of the Regent's Canal in Poole Street, Hoxton, in the former metropolitan borough of Shoreditch, London. And Chris, you know where all that area is, right?
Yeah, it is. It's
down the block?
Yep, you can get to everywhere in England just by walking 5 minutes in every direction. It's true.
Gainsborough Studios were active between 1924 and 1951, and Gainsborough would produce 12 of Hitch's films, starting with The Pleasure Garden. They would also produce The Lodger, The Mountain Eagle, Downhill, Easy Virtue, Waltzes from Vienna, The Man Who Knew Too Much, the first one, The 39 Steps, Secret Agent, Sabotage, Young and Innocent, and The Lady Vanishes. Hitchcock was also familiar with Gainsborough as they produced several of the early films that Hitch worked on, which including The Prude's Fall, The Passionate Adventure, and The Blackguard. Some other famous directors that would work with Gainsborough multiple times were Carol Reed and Michael Powell. The film was shot entirely at Amelka Film Studios, which was later called Bavaria Film, in Munich, Germany, and it's one of Europe's largest film production companies with some 30 subsidiaries. Some famous films shot here were Paths of Glory by Kubrick in 1957, The Sound of Music in 1965, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in 71, Wolfgang Peterson's Enemy Mine in 85, and The Snowden Files in 2015. One other person that worked on this film that may have placed some significance later on was the assistant director, who was Alma Revel. So we might be hearing about that person a little bit later on. And the film starred Virginia Valli and Carmelita Gerotti. Both of these women worked in the film industry for about 10 years, starting in the silent era and ended during the early sound era.
So, sorry, they're pretty, but their voices are hell. Sorry.
Well, I don't know. We'll get to this later, but I mean, like, the quality of the one that I was watching online, like, it was challenging to watch because I watched it on YouTube and I watched it on my TV, and the quality of the film was so muddy that I honestly couldn't tell the two girls apart a couple of times. I'm like, which woman is this that I'm looking at? So, because they wear their hair the same and their faces are just blanched on the image that I'm
the
watching.
The scene where they're in the bedroom and they're both getting ready for bed and it's like, I'm like, okay, which is which? Yeah. Same idea.
Yeah. Okay, now we're going to pass the mic off to Tom, and he's going to give us a synopsis of the film for those that didn't watch it.
Courtesy of the book, It's Only a Movie by Charlotte Chandler. This book belongs to Brandon, so I should really stop making pen marks on all the pages. titles and credits share the scene of a 1920s chorus girl who appears on one side looking almost like a dancing doll. Then other chorus girls scamper down the backstage spiral staircase of the Paradise Garden Theater. Jill Shane, played by Carmelita Gerotti, is applying for a job as a dancer, and she's befriended by the chorus girl Patsy Brand, played by Virginia Valli, who invites her to stay with her. Patsy persuades the theater manager, played by George Schnell, to give Jill a chance, and the audacious young woman dances so well, he hires her instantly. Jill is a star of the show. Though engaged, she becomes the girlfriend of an older Russian prince, and Jill's fiancé, Hugh Fielding, arrives with his friend Levitt. Hugh then leaves for the Far East to seek his fortune. He works at a plantation and has to go away for work 2 years at a time. Patsy is charmed by Levitt and marries him. Levitt tires of Patsy and leaves to join Hugh. Though heartbroken, when she learns he is sick, Patsy goes to nurse Levitt. And when she arrives at the island, she finds him living with a native girl, played by Nita Naldi. Feverish and drunk, he throws the girl out and demands that Patsy stay. But Patsy leaves. An English doctor asks Patsy if she will help nurse another sick white man. Levitt drowns the native girl in the sea, and then the sick white man is actually Hugh. He imagines Patsy is Jill. Levitt returns, making threats. And then to protect Hugh, Patsy goes with Levitt to his bungalow. Imagining that he sees the ghost of the native girl, Levitt attacks Patsy with a sword. The doctor arrives and shoots Levitt. And after that, Patsy and Hugh return to London together.
You know what? I am absolutely thrilled by that summary, because that means I did understand what was going on in this movie.
Well, and behind the scenes, they're traveling like a little film crew. They're running out of money. Hitchcock is borrowing money off of the actors. They're losing luggage on taxis. The female that was slotted to play the native girl that drowns refused to do the drowning scene. So they took a waitress from the hotel and said, "Hey, you want to be in a film?" Like, it was just guerrilla filmmaking. We get this impression that all these famous films are very well coordinated and well backed and well executed, but I'm surprised they got this one made at all.
On a whole, first things first here, how was it watching this first silent film the whole way through for you guys? Is Chris?
I mean, I watched it a few weeks ago, because originally we were going to move it in a different episode, but it was really cool rewatching it this weekend, and it makes a lot more sense the second time round, because the first time round, you know, because we did watch it on YouTube, and you're right that the picture quality isn't the best, but given the fact that it was done in the mid to late 1920s, we're lucky that it's able to be digitized at all and understand what's going on. I mean, in terms of, what's it like watching a silent film? I quite like watching silent films. We've discussed this before, but there's not a huge amount of them actually remaining in terms of, like, compared to how many, you know, early sound pictures there still remain. So, but in terms of the film and everything, I enjoyed it. I mean, there's a brilliant quote from critic Dave Kerr, and it points out that the Pleasure Gardens opening sequence is like a virtual clip reel of Hitchcock motifs to come, with the very first shot capturing chorus girls descending a spiral staircase, such as in Vertigo, a man using opera glasses to better appreciate a blonde chorus dancer, such as Rear Window, and the same blonde who at first appears erotically remote, later emerges as down-to-earth and approachable, such as in Family Plot, which was Hitchcock's last film. And I think that's interesting, because it does make sense, and, you know, when you watch The Pleasure Garden, it is really fascinating to sort of see all of these, the little motifs and everything in the opening scene, but then the storyline itself isn't too dissimilar from what a lot of Hitchcock's films were about, when it was about kind of the entanglement of relationships. And there was the element of violence, you know, in the last scene where Patsy's being hunted down by kind of an enraged Levitt. It has that kind of psycho feel to it. It has that frenzy feel to it, even though obviously it was 50 years or, you know, 40 years before he would ever go on to do anything like Frenzy, or earlier than that, Psycho. So it is really interesting to sort of see that even in his first film, these elements still pop up and appear, and they're like kind of precursors or forewarnings as to what a lot of his films are going to be about. And there's obviously exceptions. Not every film's going to be about, it's about love and heartbreak and a guy who goes mad at the end and tries to kill someone. But it is fascinating when you look at his career as a whole and have a look at this as, like, the official first chapter in his filmmaking and the thing he's had a lot of creative control over.
Tom, what do you think?
I enjoyed it. I think I've got a pretty thick skin for silent films. I'm pretty used to watching them. I did a lot of years working in television production where sometimes you're sitting 8 hours logging footage and it's not always entertaining and fun. So I've got a pretty good tolerance for watching film formats that are unusual. So I enjoyed the silent film nature of the film. I got into the historic, you know, relevance of it. And again, though, it's tricky to follow the story. You got to realize that you're taking so much from facial expression, and you're filling in the blanks as far as what the characters are doing and saying. The part I found very interesting within the first 2 minutes or so, this Patsy is dancing on stage, And there's this man in the audience that, you know, uses his influence to get to meet her and say hi, which is a little bit of a foreshadow to what Hitchcock was like professionally with his actresses. So I found that very interesting.
Yeah.
But no, overall, I really enjoyed it. And it's an hour long. That's not a long, that's not a bad length for a piece of film.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. I think because it was an hour, made it a little bit easier for me to watch. I've mentioned in the past that I find it difficult to watch silent films. I don't watch a lot of silent films. I appreciate them, and I wish I could enjoy them a bit more. Maybe I just need more practice, because it is a completely different experience watching a silent movie than it is watching a sound movie. And I mean, for our whole life, I've been watching sound films. Like, the black and white aspect doesn't matter to me. Like, I watch black and white movies all the time. So I know that some people don't like to watch black and white movies, but that doesn't bother me. But with it being an hour, it was pretty concise, so I was able to follow along. Maybe it's my attention span. Maybe it's because I'm a child of the 80s and I ate too much sugar growing up. I don't know. Who knows, right?
I'm still eating too much sugar.
But I still found my mind wandering a couple of times. And I mean, like you had mentioned in the summary, that's why I said I'm glad I understood this movie, because I'm watching it, and near the end there, when he throws like that what did they call her, the local native girl, the Aboriginal girl, native girl, okay, so this native girl looks like she's walking into the ocean to kill herself and drown herself.
Yeah.
And then he comes out there and I'm like, oh, he's gonna save her, and then he like drowns her, and I'm like, what? Did that just happen? Did he just kill her?
What island is this? Polynesia? Is it a banana
something
plantation?
Like, well, it could be a coffee plantation. They just said plantation a couple of times. Could be coffee, could be bananas,
again,
could be pineapple.
Ethnocentric film crews. We're going to take a white actress and make her play a native character. It's just very typical.
Oh, man, the best of that. Oh, man, I'm drawing a blank on the movie title. Was that movie where Charlton Heston plays a Mexican.
Yeah.
Right? I'm drawing a blank on it, but it's that movie that has the long
Charlton
bomb,
Heston.
The bomb at the beginning and everything. So, yeah, they've done that once or twice in Hollywood. Was there any shots in this film that really stood out to you as, hey, that's a Hitchcock shot?
I was amazed that they did an underwater camera.
Mm.
That it was one quick cut when they were drowning the lady at the end, and I don't know how they did it, or like the cameras back when would have been the size of a Volkswagen. So that was quite a trick to pull off.
I'm trying to think, like the underwater shots are really good, but I swear in the last sequence, because I've mentioned this before with Levitt and Patsy, it's not so much like a particular shot that I think is quite good, but it's the whole sequence where she's hiding and he's chasing after her, and it just screams Hitchcock to me, because it is very tense, and because, as you know, you guys have mentioned, the fact that there isn't any dialogue, it's all facially based, which I know sounds really stupid, but a lot of the time we go off stuff based on what we can hear and what we can, you know, what the soundtrack provides for us. So to have that, and it's just kind of raw emotion, everything. I just thought it was a really good sequence. And I quite like when they descend the staircase at the beginning, everything. Because it reminds me of Indiana Jones. Just the chorus, that sequence.
Okay.
Hitchcock likes stairs.
Mm-hmm.
He does. And that spiral staircase is almost one of his trademarks.
Mm-hmm. There was a couple of shots in here that to me felt really, really Hitchcockian, and they were very much at the beginning. So a couple of them were when the guy was looking through his glasses, and then they showed the close-up of he was looking right at their legs as they were dancing. The other one was actually that shot as well, is he took off his monocle, and it was blurry, and then he brought up the goggles, and it brought it into focus. I really thought that was very, very cool. And then right after that, there was a shot. I don't remember which character it was, because it happened so quickly. But there's a guy leaning against a wall with a large no smoking sign, and he's sitting there smoking a big cigar.
That,
so to me, those couple of shots,
him as the executive, the owner of the building, he could do what he wants. That was his social class, right?
Excellent. Oh, see, I didn't even catch it. I just thought it was a really cool shot that he was... I'm like, this is a Hitchcock thing, just to throw that no smoking
sign
up there.
The sexuality of the dancing girls and the legs, To us, it's like, eh, whatever. But back in that day, it would have been, oh, my good Lord, Henry, close your eyes. You know, it would have been quite pushing it for film content.
Well, was this before or after the Hays Code? Do you know?
This would have been before. Let me just, while we're talking here, I'll Google the Hays Code and see when that came out. I'm pretty sure this would have been free.
So maybe it wasn't as shocking, but compared to what we're used to, yeah, you're right in that it's not like... You know, we see stuff in the film all the time that, you know, 12-year-olds can see. And back then, it would have been absolutely shocking, even for pre-Hays Code era films. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, we're talking about silent film and the difficulty of watching silent film. Brandon Harbecki is one of our loyal listeners who comments on Facebook. Thank you, Brandon. So he says, regarding silent movies, he has trouble watching them, even when they're well made, like The Lodger and Metropolis. One reason may be that the frame rate is less than 24 frames per second, making it look like the action is unnaturally sped up. So for those films with intertitles, the actor is talking without sound before the card looks wrong to him. And a different comment of his... When we did sort of an assignment on Facebook, assigned viewing, you guys should watch Pleasure Garden before we tape this episode and make comments. He said he made it 4 minutes into the film before he gave up. He just couldn't watch the film. But that's 4 minutes more than, you know, other people. So, whatever technical improvements and film conventions were put into place between the Pleasure Garden and Blackmail were immense. And that is discounting the element of sound, he says. He looks forward to hearing about the brilliant touches that Hitchcock may have added to the film, but he just does not enjoy the experience of watching a silent movie. So my comments on this, you know, talkies are natural and relaxing for us to watch as modern-day film viewers. You can look away and still hear what the dialogue, what the action is. In a silent film like The Pleasure Garden, it's a lot of work. You have to do a lot to, as a viewer... You have to read the exaggerated expressions on the faces. You have to partake in pantomime. You have to decide if what you think is happening is happening. My example, the man that carried the trunk into the boarding house bedroom there, is he upset that he didn't get a tip for doing this because the woman has no money? Like, those are things we have to kind of intuitively read. Now... You also have to read the title cards, the intertitles. It can be hard to sort out the characters in a silent film, which we talked about, as you don't have the sound of their voices to go by. And without hearing the actors' voices, we lose all the emotion, the tension, the excitement, the fear, all those things which can be conveyed verbally. And so many people do say they find a silent film hard to watch. That's the burden of being a film fan. We must watch these films and experience and appreciate them for what they are. We cannot experience them the same way that viewers of the day did. As those people were naive, this is all that they knew. This stuff was impressive to them. We are moving backwards technologically to watch these films. We know there are better things to come with talkies. Who wants to go see a talkie?
I love that term.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, while you were talking about that, I Googled up the Hays Code here, and it looks like the Hays Code came into effect in 1930. So the Motion Picture Production Code of 1930, so the MPPC. And in it, some of the general principles are, you know, no picture shall be produced that will lower the moral standards of those who see it. Hence, the sympathy of the audience should never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. Correct standards of life subject only to the requirements of drama and entertainment shall be presented. Law, natural or human, shall not be ridiculed, nor shall sympathy be created for its violation. And then there's like a bunch of subcodes, like crimes against the law shouldn't be, you know, like murder. The technique of murder must be presented in a way that will not inspire imitation. And, you know, methods of crime should not be explicitly presented. There's codes for sex, adultery. Sometimes necessary plot material must not be explicitly treated or justified or presented attractively. Scenes of passion, they should not be introduced when not essential to the plot. And so I'm wondering at what time these codes got thrown out the window.
I think they got chipped away element by element over the years.
Yeah.
Yep.
What film was it in the 50s that the leading man appeared on screen in a t-shirt. Like, he was in bed, but he was wearing a t-shirt. Oh. He was in bed with a woman, and it was, oh my God, he's wearing a t-shirt. And in the general American population, men started wearing t-shirts because this was now accepted, where they were normally an undershirt. But that type of, today we think about that as like, what are you talking about? But that was actually scandalous back in the day.
Well, and Psycho was the first film to show a toilet flushing on camera. God. You know, like...
I love the idea. Just like, what do you mean? What do you mean your toilet flushes? We've been using it wrong for years.
Have you guys ever been in a theater? Sorry. They flush. That's what I'm doing wrong. Have you ever been in a theater during a film and had people walk out because of something that just happened or something they know is about to happen?
No.
Not that I've ever noticed. So.
No.
I was at kind of a private screening of The Green Mile. It was a bunch of staff that worked at a shopping mall that kind of opened the theater after midnight and showed it to 20 people. And the girl walked out because she knew there was the electrocution of the inmate, Philip Michael Thomas, I believe. And she knew this horrible scene was coming up, so she walked out. But that whole idea that you're going to miss that part of the film and you're going to see an incomplete film and you're not going to experience all of the imagery kind of baffles me.
I mean, if you know that you're just not going to enjoy it and it might ruin it, then
Michael Clark Duncan. Pardon me.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm definitely not against people. If it's something that's going to get them, make them genuinely upset, then that's fine. Because I can't help but feel that if you're just going to miss 2 minutes, I can't help but feel that if your whole film hinges on 2 minutes, it's not very well made. So if they miss a 2 minute scene where it's gratuitous, if it's like a bit of violence or if it's something gross that you don't particularly like, and you come back in afterwards and the film makes no sense from then on, then it's not great. It's not, it doesn't make a lot of sense. If that makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
So The Usual Suspects, that final scene?
Well, yeah, but even then, that's like the finale to the whole thing. So even then, you should have been able to be like, oh, okay, maybe it's, maybe it's this, or maybe it's that sort of thing. It's not... Yeah, I think there's a bit of a difference between, oh, if there's like a bit of violence or something horrific, and then, oh, it's literally just a plot development. If that makes sense. Sometimes the two are linked, and that's absolutely fine. But if someone, like if I had a friend, if we went to the movies, and it was a violent film, and they said, listen, I've heard about this scene. Someone's eyes going to get popped out graphically on screen. I cannot be in.
I'd love that.
I'll be back in. And will you text me, or will you just like come out when it's over and just say, yeah, it's fine, and we can go back in? Yeah, I honestly don't mind.
Well, you guys have any more comments on The Pleasure Garden before we move on to Mountain Eagle?
Nope.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was all right.
I think it's worth watching.
Yeah. Right on. Give it a chance. Give it a try. It's only an hour on YouTube. Right? Doesn't cost you anything but an hour.
Yeah, and there's lots of versions to pick from.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
The thing that threw me a little bit that I figured out once I put some effort into it, one of the intertitles near the beginning says Meat Patsy Brand. And then underneath it says Virginia Valley. And I'm like, what is that? My first thought was, did some historian research and, write that intertitle? And they got a credit, but it's just the actress's name.
Right, yeah. You mentioned that, and I noticed that on the version I watched, too. I've never seen that in a silent film before, where the actress's or the actor's name was put with their intertitle. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that before.
And to me, it doesn't really make sense.
No.
In a talkie, you would never go, hey, look, you just walked in. It's Harrison Ford. But that's what they did back in the day. And, yeah, there's a page. The highly popular reviews at the Pleasure Garden Theater are staged by Mr. Hamilton. And then the credit underneath, George Snell.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's a modern intertitle that the company which reproduced the film and digitized it built in, or maybe that's the way it appeared back in the day. I would rather see what appeared back in the day.
Well, let's move along to The Mountain Eagle, which is Hitchcock's second film and the last lost film that we'll be discussing. Now, according to the BFI website, which is the British Film Institute, the film was 83 minutes long. The film was produced by Michael Balkan of Gainsborough Pictures, and the screenplay was written by the previously mentioned Elliot Stannard and Max Ferner. Now, we already went over Elliot Stannard's stuff, but Max Ferner was a German playwright born Maximilian Sommer, and he was born on April 18th, 1881. The story for the film was written by Charles Lapworth, who was a journalist. Lapworth would work on A Dog's Life with Charlie Chaplin as a writer and a consultant, and in the 20s he was an editor for the Los Angeles Graphic newspaper. He would also work as a production manager for the short-lived Société Générale des Films, who made The Passion of Joan of Arc by Carl Dreyer. The film starred Nita Naldi, Bernard Getzky, Malcolm Keane, and John F. Hamilton. And the notable connections and notable films that I found were, for Nita Naldi, she was in the 1923 version of The Ten Commandments, and Bernard Getzky was in The Brothers Karamazov from 1921, Dr. Mabuse the Gambler from 1922, and he previously worked on the Hitchcock-related picture in 1925 with The Black Guard. Malcolm Keane would later work with Hitch in The Lodger and The Manxman, and John F. Hamilton had previously worked on Hitch with The Passionate Adventure. And we'll pass the mic on over to Chris, and he'll read the synopsis of this lost picture.
Yeah. So this synopsis is taken from the Bioscope on the 7th of October, 1926. Beatrice Brent, schoolteacher in a small mountain village, incurs the enmity of Pettigrew, the local justice of the peace and owner of the village stores, because he believes that she encourages the attentions of his son Edward, a cripple, who takes evening lessons. Pettigrew, while questioning Beatrice, is himself influenced by her charm and attempts liberties which she strongly resents. He is so furious at the rebuff that he proclaims her as a wanton, and she is driven from the village by the inhabitants. Beatrice is saved from their fury by a mysterious stranger known as Firagod, who lives a solitary life in a cabin to which he takes her for shelter. To stop all scandal, Firagod takes Beatrice down to the village and compels Pettigrew to marry them, explaining to her that he will help her to get a divorce. Beatrice, however, is content to leave the situation as it is, but Pettigrew, furious with rage, takes advantage of the fact that his son has left the village and arrests Firagod for his murder. In spite of the fact that there is no vestige of evidence that young Pettigrew has been murdered, Firagod is kept in prison for over a year when he decides to escape. He finds that his wife has a baby and goes off with them to the mountains. When they find the baby is taken ill, Firagod goes back to the village for a doctor, where he sees old Pettigrew. Some doubt as to which of the men is going to attack the other first is settled by an onlooker firing off a gun, which wounds Pettigrew in the shoulder. The sudden return of his son Edward convinces the old man of the futility of proceeding with his accusations of murder, so he makes the best of matters by shaking hands with the man he persecuted, and all is supposed to end happily.
Wow.
That is intense.
Mm-hmm. I like the name Firagod.
Fear of God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Fear of God.
Fear of God. That was like originally, there's some stories that say that that was the name of the title of the movie when released in the States, but something that I was looking up says that there was actually one surviving one sheet, and it wasn't called The Fear of God. So that it may have been, it may have not have been called that, but when it came over to the States, because sometimes in different countries, movies have different titles, right?
Yeah.
There's a review from the day of from the magazine, newspaper, Lantern Weekly. It was a rather wandering and not too convincing of a film. It was probably not a big issue that was quickly lost. No surviving copy was confirmed, and the impression of the stills that Hitchcock was continuing to experiment with German film techniques. Even Hitchcock himself called it a very bad movie. So, good consensus.
But the BFI website has this to say on why they're so keen to find the film. So this is taken directly from the BFI website. First of all, they say, because it's Hitchcock. Among the most wanted of all missing films, The Mountain Eagle is the only one of Hitchcock's films as a director to be lost, save for the never-completed Number 13 from 1922, which we talked about previously, and hence something of a holy grail for film historians. It was dismissed by Hitchcock in conversations with François Truffaut as a very bad movie. But then, the director could be brutally disparaging about his early films, notably The Farmer's Wife and The Manxman, the second of which, in particular, is widely judged as a very fine example of advanced silent film style. And this movie was shot between his directorial debut, The Pleasure Garden, and his breakthrough third film, The Lodger. It's unlikely that The Mountain Eagle is a lost masterpiece, and both the synopsis and contemporary reviews suggest that the story is at least weak. But many of the same reviewers also praise the direction and photography, and it's almost certain, as the available stills suggest, that the film contained fascinating glimpses of the Hitchcock style in embryonic form and provided further insights into his German influences. And so, yeah, all we have now is a couple of still images. I think it was like 10 or 12 still images that were found in Hitchcock's collection, and that's all that we've got from this movie. So,
something productive did come from this film.
Ooh, you know what that tell is? Me.
They were in the German Alps filming, and on the journey home, on the way back to England by ship, on Christmas Eve, during a violent storm, Hitchcock proposed to Alma. Isn't that romantic?
Aww. Yeah.
And she was sick in the cabin with seasickness and sat up in bed and said yes and burped and went back to sleep. So it kind of loses the charm. But that was when they got engaged.
Yeah.
I think that's a perfectly accurate Hitchcock story. That's something definitely that he would say. She burped.
Weirdly, this film does frame part of their marriage as well. So on the Hitchcock Zone, there's a 1937 interview with Hitchcock called Life Among the Stars from the News Chronicle, and it talks about how he went through the process of actually filming The Mountain Eagle, saying, okay, we quarreled about this, we quarreled about that. A lot of it is about the lead actress, whose name I have just completely forgotten, Nita Naldi. And it just talks about saying, oh, well, she came across the Atlantic to do one thing, but she was completely different to what I had in mind, and so we argued about this and all that sort of thing. And then the last sentence, just going off the marriage thing, I think is, it's sweet and it's really funny. It just says, a few weeks later, when Alma and I were married, we went to Paris for our honeymoon and spent the first day of it with Nita, but that is another story and one I'm not going to tell. That's awesome. I want to know more than anything what they did.
Well, there was something I read back, like when we were starting the podcast, so literally probably 2 months ago.
Yeah.
I couldn't find it today, but there was a story of Germany and partying in an apartment and a couple of women and a couple of women and stuff and different things going on. That, and Hitchcock was famous for being approved. Like, he was very, you know, clean living and sort of non-sexual. And apparently there were some events in that apartment that one night that quite impressed him.
And we'll leave that to your imagination. Well, if you look on the Hitchcock Zone as well, they've got, looks like 14 images taken from, you know, behind the scenes and images that are stills from the film and stuff like that. So, you know, it's kind of neat to be able to see these. I mean, there's a great shot of this crazy looking guy with these glasses and curly hair, and he's getting like strangled from behind or something, and he's got these crazy teeth. So, I mean, I would like to see it just for this shot, right? But yeah, it's
so pretty, couldn't this be a film that somebody could remake?
I mean, if they found a script for it, not that I know of, but you know, if somebody found a script, they probably could.
I guess if Hitchcock was alive, he could help write a script.
Excellent. Well, anything else you guys want to say on The Mountain Eagle before we sign off for today?
I wish a copy of it actually existed so we could have seen it.
Yeah.
Chris was a little bitter about being assigned a film we couldn't watch.
Well, it's not bitter,
it's
but
historic.
It's just,
it's important.
Yeah. Oh, no, it is important. And it is interesting because there's more documentation about this one. So we do have the images, we do have the interviews and all that sort of thing. It's a shame that we can't actually watch it.
Yeah.
Leave them wanting more.
Leave them
wanting more.
Can I do a quick Hitchcock Marketplace item?
Please.
Of all the different novelty items and accessories and toys that have been sold over the years.
Sure.
There's an item, copyright 2000 by the University Games Corporation in San Francisco. It's a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, which I hate. And Jeanette bought it for me a couple years ago, and this Christmas I cleaned off the dining room table and set it up. Now, somebody thought they were clever, and they give you a 20-page short story to read. They do not give you a photo of the puzzle. They don't give you a photo of what the puzzle's supposed to look like.
Oh, no.
Right? So it's supposed to be like, read this short story, figure out what you think is in the puzzle, and then build the 1,000-piece black and white puzzle. And I don't know if any of you are puzzlers, but I enjoy the challenge once in a while. Usually at Christmas, it's something to set up. The cat likes to help me. And they can be fun. But I was able to find on Google Images a photo of what this puzzle looked like. But even then, it was so hard that I literally just gave up. I said, to heck with it. And I do not recommend this as a challenge that anyone partake in. And I've got a copy of the puzzle if somebody wants a free one.
You know, I actually did one of those once, and you were supposed to solve the story based on the image, right?
Yeah.
And there was, like, a fish in there, and they're like, that's the red herring, and, like, you know, and whatnot. Is that the same one?
Well, I think there was a series, like, 10 different...
Okay.
You know, they did a Hitchcock one, and it's the Bepuzzled Classics series.
I think I had one of those, yeah.
But I was not impressed.
I've had a worse jigsaw experience, if that helps. I got... In where I work, basically, we do the Secret Santa thing, but then we also do the Lucky Dip. So basically, you buy something for a quid, for a pound, wrap it up, and then
the
everyone
squid?
Just...
You pay with fish? What?
Calamari.
Yeah. Well, we are a coastal country. And you just pick something and unwrap it, and it's just whatever the random gift is. And I got a Disney jigsaw of... two or three princesses, and I was like, well, I like Disney, and it's only 25 pieces, I can do this. Except one of the pieces was missing, and it genuinely horrified my family friend who came around, and she's only about 9, because it the bit that was missing was Belle from Beauty and the Beast, and it was her face. So there was just like a headless princess on the thing, and she's like, where's her face gone?
The headless princess.
Well, I had to be like, yeah, this is what happens when people just get any crap off a shelf.
My brother Ted, growing up, he was a Rubik's Cube guy.
All right.
I would take his Rubik's Cube when it was solved, take one of the side pieces and flip it, like remove it and put it back in, shuffle it and put it back down. For weeks, he couldn't solve his Rubik's Cube.
That is evil.
Evil. I will teach him.
Unbelievable.
There you go, Brandon. Quality content.
We will sign off, and I'm going to go and cry.
Tell us about your podcast, Brandon.
Well, before I do that, actually, I'll just let the listeners know. So, episode 6, we're going to be covering The Lodger, which Hitchcock himself considers his first Hitchcock film. And then for episode 7, we'll be covering Bates Motel Season 1.
Right,
and at some point in there... we're also going to have an interview with Chris Bacon, who's the composer for Bates Motel. I've arranged to have an interview with him, and I'll have done the interview by the time this episode drops. But depending on how long the interview is, we might release it as a supplemental by itself, or we may include it in our Bates Motel discussion, just depending on how much we can get out of that. So I'm very much looking forward to that. But never forget that Good Evening is available on the Fandom Podcast Network, and you can find us, just search for Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. We don't have an independent feed yet, so it is under the master feed of the Fandom Podcast Network, but there's a couple of other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can find the Fandom Podcast, you can email them, fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com, on Instagram, Fandom Podcast Network, and Twitter, @FanPodNetwork. And as for our show, you can find us on Facebook, just search Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, you'll find it, and we'll come right up. And you can find us on Twitter, @GoodEveningPod, and you can email us as well. Please do. We would love to hear your comments. GoodEveningPodcast@Hotmail.com. And Tom, where can people find you?
My Instagram handle is TheTomCaldwell. As I'd like to say, it's a lot of photos of my dog. But it's worth it. Check it out. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Chris, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @hire_boy. So apart from Good Evening Pod, I also co-host a show with one of my best friends, Emma Platt, and that's North by Nerd West. We cover all kinds of nerdy things.
Tom, he just plugged his podcast twice this episode.
That's
okay. You know,
Chris, we're gonna have to have a talk. Policies and procedure. It's a good podcast. I enjoyed it. I listened to it out in the garden the one day.
I regret so many of my life choices.
No, we're just teasing episode 12.
But no,
Chris's life choices.
Yeah. I love it. It's just like an intervention.
I apologize. Brandon has to edit today's show.
Yeah. That's fine. It's nothing bad. I'll probably leave this all in. Tangents are fun. That's what makes people chuckle when they listen. Sorry, I interrupted you. Keep going, Chris.
No,
North by Nerd West.
North by Nerd West. We're on Twitter at North by Nerd West. You can email us. We're on iTunes and Blogger, so feel free to listen in if you fancy it. I hope you do. But yeah, you can just find me on Twitter at @hire_boy, where I'll just be talking nonsense and possibly some politics, because we've just had the UK elections over here, and that's all anybody's talked about for the past 3 months. So
that is a brilliant podcast title.
Oh, thank you.
I enjoy that.
And you can find me over on the Trek FM network, where I host two shows. I host a show called Melodic Treks, which is all about the music of Star Trek, and I've been taking a few tangents over there to movies that are composed by Trek composers that aren't Star Trek. We did a great episode on Patriot Games, which was composed by James Horner, and I had one that's just come out about Hunt for October by Basil Poledouris. Now, while he never composed for Star Trek, he actually played a redshirt in an episode of season 2 of the original series, and he played a Klingon in season 1. So, you know, I'm really pushing the limits on what I can do on my show there, but that's okay. And my other show is called Warp 5, which is all about the Star Trek Enterprise show, and I co-host that with my friend Floyd, and that's a lot of fun over there. So you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. And
you're a busy guy.
I am a busy guy, yes.
Is it Patriot Games as in the Harrison Ford film?
It is, yeah.
Oh my god, I'm so listening to that. I love that film.
Anyway, yeah, it was a really, really good discussion with John Takis. So
and red shirt means he gets killed, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I think he does. It's been a while. But yeah, I guess until next time, good evening.
Good evening.
Pleasure Garden,
aka the Garden of Pleasure.
Mm-hmm. A pleasure garden for me would be like a garden filled with corn and spinach and radishes.
Really? Thank you for that little insight.
To each their own.
Okay, so